Well, good afternoon and welcome to another episode of The Good Source. I'm Mark Powell and this is Cultural Markisms. This afternoon I have a very special guest with me and that's Mrs. Moira Deeming. Moira is a researcher with the Church and Nation Committee, which is a committee of the Presbyterian Church of Australia looking into ethical issues. So good afternoon, Moira. It's great to have you with us.
Good afternoon. It's great to be here.
Now, Moira, you have a really fascinating background. I'm sure lots of people are going to be really interested in hearing your story because really it's one of moving, I guess you would say, broadly speaking, from the left to the right, from a progressive to a more conservative viewpoint of the world. Can you just tell us a little bit about your personal background?
So I come from a very politically involved Labor voting Catholic family, non-practicing Catholic, but quite left-wing. I think they're what the left wing used to be when it was more centre-left. But, you know, basically I grew up in this household surrounded by very powerful, influential women who were leaders in the union movement. All of my mum's friends were all very high earners, powerful women. Most of them were divorced. They had children but got divorced. And so actually, you know, I grew up in a matriarchy, I think, where men were a little bit superfluous and and, you know, it's really ironic and funny to my mum that, yeah, I've ended up being a stay-at-home mum in the end, you know, with four children. And
so then I've got to ask, what happened?
A few things happened. I can't go into too much detail, but my mum used to work for a union and she, you know, lots of people who work at unions work there out of extremely good motives and I was all pro-union and she just found out that some of the people above her were being really corrupt. And she wouldn't be a part of it. And they became afraid of her and they started to bully her and harass her. And I used to go there after school and sit in the waiting room and whatever. And sometimes people wouldn't know that she was my mum and they'd start talking about her and, you know, plotting the lies that they were going to start spreading about her. And I would just be thinking, wow, my goodness, these people. Anyway, it all came to a head where mum had to go and see a lawyer and they had treated her so badly, so publicly and left evidence so far and wide that there was a payout. Mum didn't want to take the money, but the lawyer said this is the only way to get them to stop. And so she took the payout and she left the job and the people who did bully her went straight up in the organisation and that money came out of the union. And mum was really upset that basically these ordinary workers who put aside money every pay to pay that organisation to look after their rights had just paid to keep this set of bullies and to stop them from, you know, and they'd lost the one that wasn't going to be corrupt or involved in it. And that really turned me against unions. I thought, how come people can't know about this? When I found out about the laws that unions don't have to have as much transparency as corporations, I really thought, yeah, they're like wolves in sheep's clothing. And I just became disillusioned about that. And then it was just lots of things, becoming a teacher, listening to that left-wing rhetoric at university. You know, there was just lots of strange things that they would say to me which didn't make sense, you know, like if a child can't read, make sure you get books that are down on their level. And I thought, but if they can't read, shouldn't we teach them to read? Shouldn't we stop what we're doing and make sure they can read before we go on? It just seemed backwards. And then, you know, I was in schools and there was all this I was in quite a few poor schools for my teaching rounds and I had never been in such poor areas and in public schools. I was a privileged left-wing person, went to privileged schools and all that kind of thing. And I was really devastated about their lives and I was very sad about it and I really wanted them to have hope for their future. And I found that the messages that they were getting were stealing their sense of agency. It was all encouraging them to think of themselves as a victim, to think about how bad their lives are and how hard it's going to be for them. And I thought, they're so young, they've got so much potential, you can get out from under your childhood. Surely we should be giving them a message of hope. And I started to turn again, you know, when I met my husband. My husband's very conservative. When I told my mum that, you know, he might be asking, you know, it's getting a bit serious with him, you know, I said, there are two things you need to know about him. And she said, oh, what are they? And I said, you know, he's a born-again Christian. She's Catholic, so she's, you know, he's Presbyterian. And I said, you know, and he's also, you know, dyed in the blue liberal. And she was like, oh, Moira. You know, it was like her nightmare. but he was one of the only people actually on the conservative spectrum who bothered to make a case for his beliefs. Normally when I came up against conservatives, they'd just say some garbage about how he's an idiot lefty. They didn't actually take the time to speak to me and take my concerns seriously. In fact, what he did was he did it so gently that he ended up saying, you know, I think you might want to take a political compass test. You know, I'm not sure that party represents your beliefs. And I took the political compass test and I was further to the right than he was.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't know that I was voting for a party that didn't even align with my views. And
Now,
and it just went on from there.
So your husband, when you met him, was a Christian. What about yourself? Would you describe yourself as always having Christian faith, or was there a particular point where you came to trust in Christ?
No, not from a Christian family. I'm pretty scornful of Christianity and Christians, I would say. And no, my best friend became a Christian when we were 16, and I just thought, what is this insanity? But I respected her and I just adored her. And over the next couple of years, she became an even more amazing person, and her life just ate away at me, and I just couldn't believe how she was changing into an even nicer, more honest person. You know, I thought little lies weren't that bad. She would not tell any little lie anymore. She became less vain. She became she just became a more attractive person in every single way to me. And it was real. It wasn't a looking down on other people thing. It wasn't a holier than thou thing. It wasn't a do good thing. I think I had this, you know, that Catholic guilt that you do good because it's the right thing to do, which isn't bad. But there was something alive about her faith that I hadn't seen before.
Okay.
And, you know, that really troubled me. And, then when I was 18, she gave me a Bible for my birthday. She thought that was going to be the end of our friendship, her giving me that Bible. She was terrified. Because all those years, you know, I'd been asking questions, well, what about gay people? How can God say that about gay people? That's terrible, you know. And if she didn't have an answer to something, she'd say, I'll have a look into that. That's a good question, you know. Again, she didn't brush me off. She listened to me and she didn't overreact. She told me years later that she was petrified of all my questions. And so I think I must have, she said, you looked so aggressive. And I said, oh, I was probably just nervous because I was, it was eating me up inside. And then, at university, I became a Christian when I was 18. I started going to the Christian Union, and that's where I met my husband.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Now, you're also a trained teacher, and I read a fascinating article that you wrote, sort of talking really about your journey from being a state school teacher to now being a homeschooling mum. Can you tell us a little bit about that journey and why you've gone down that path?
Yes. I did a Bachelor of International Relations, but, you know, at the end of our degree, they had this headhunting session with the United Nations, DFAT, ASIO, all these people, and they all said you couldn't have a family. And I knew that I wanted a family, and I had just gotten engaged to my husband. And I came out of that headhunting session and I said, I've always wanted to be a teacher. I'm just going to be a teacher. That's what I want to do. So I went and did my teaching degree, and I loved being a teacher. I really enjoyed it. I think I was a good teacher and I was getting better year by year. Sadly, my eldest daughter got bullied, actually, at the school that I was a teacher at, and it took a long time for me to find out. I'm one of those parents, you know, having been a teacher, but, you know, if my daughter came to say to me, you know, something bad happened, I would say, and what did you do? You know, I would always try and find out the full story.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I learned was that little children are not very good at articulating things. They just cannot articulate the whole story very well. And she wasn't articulating to me just how bad it was. And I ended up getting told by two mums. They came to talk to me because their daughters were in tears about being bullied into bullying my daughter. And did I know? And I just felt terrible because she had been trying to tell me and I didn't pick up on it. So that was a bit shattering. And that had been going on for a whole year. Anyway, so I spoke to the school and I said, you know, can you put her in a different class from this girl? And they did. And then the teacher that she had, unfortunately, they had a personality clash. I think my eldest had been a little bit damaged. But this teacher, I found out later on, years later, a few other people had went through the school like we did, kinder, prep, had this woman in grade one rip their kids out and homeschooled because this woman in grade one was so bad. This was my colleague. I don't know exactly what she did. My daughter's told me a few things later on. It seems like she was extremely cold. So, like on the last day, she wouldn't let Eva's give out lollipops. That's my eldest daughter. And I knew that that was according to the rules that you could. I knew that that was that you could. I worked there. And she just didn't let her do it. She wouldn't let her say goodbye. Just weird cold things. Anyway, so it was a lot of damage. And I said to my husband, because she ended up starting to pull out her hair and she developed a stutter. And I just said, oh, my goodness, that's enough.
Yeah.
I said I was going to do it for 1 year and then put her in a different school.
Yeah.
And then I was going to go to state schools. I had this really deep conviction that Christians needed to go and teach in state schools. It was ridiculous to be in this bubble of a Christian school. I should go out and be a Christian teacher in a public school. Anyway, and then, but while I was home, I started reading the Safe Schools curriculum stuff, you know, just as an aside, because I'd heard about it. I didn't believe it. I thought it was all hype. I thought it was garbage. I had done sex ed. Sometimes it can get awkward, perhaps.
It is
difficult as a teacher to never go into a gray area. And I thought, surely this is just hysterical. Anyway, but then I started reading it, and it was worse than I had imagined. People were not being hysterical enough about it. I was absolutely shattered.
So at what point did you come to that realization, Moira? Was it gradual, or was it immediate alarm bells ringing?
I think I didn't really take it seriously. I think I had seen a few resources. You know, I'm humbled by this. I feel really guilty about it. But I'd seen a few resources from Christian organizations, and I think I brushed them off, to be honest, because they were Christian organizations. And it took an article in The Australian. Which mentioned a resource, and I thought, well, fine, I'll go and look up this actual resource. And I did, and it was just unbelievable. It was a survey that you give to children to ask them what sexual experiences they've had and which ones that they would consider. And there wasn't an option for none of your business, Miss or Mrs. or whoever, and or no, not ever. And I was like, what would you even do with that survey? Would I grade it? Would I put it in my filing cabinet? Would I give it back? Would we have a class discussion where everyone says what they've done? It was so insane. I just thought, this can't be happening. And I was sort of fuming and roaming around the house for 3 days, and my husband, you know, was like, Moira, don't yell at us, you know, write an article about it. So I did. I wrote an article about it. I'd never even felt the need or anything to write an article before. So I did that, and that sort of went a bit viral.
Where did you publish that article?
In The Spectator.
Yeah, right. And that was the one, we don't know if he, Arthur or Martha?
No, that was much later.
Oh, okay. That's another one that went viral.
Yeah, so I think there are three that went viral. Yeah. The second one was about, you know, I found out that they'd also then put doctors in schools, and I had been looking back, like, where, because you have, there's a law that you have to have, you know, it has to be evidence-based. Government programs have to be evidence-based. And I was like, what evidence is there that you should give a survey out to children where an adult can ask a child what sexual experiences they've had? That's sexual harassment. You couldn't do it in a staff room. You couldn't do it in a workplace. How did they get away with this? This is absurd. And I found out that it was
age range. What age range would that be for
children? That was for year nines.
Right. And so that's about 14, 15?
15, maybe 16, yeah. I mean, it depends.
Many of them below the age of consent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but it doesn't even matter to me. I'm like, you wouldn't be able to do that in a staff room. If anyone gave me that survey in a staff room, I would be all over them. They would be in huge trouble. And I thought, why are we subjecting children to behaviour we would not put up with?
Yeah.
And, you know, even some of the visuals, the posters, the even, you know, the word, you know, the descriptions, you know, you would not legally be able to have that up in a staff room or in a workplace because of sexual harassment laws. And I couldn't wrap my head around it. Anyway, and I found out it was all based on, did some deep digging, and it was all based on Alfred Kinsey. And I thought, who is Alfred Kinsey? Because I was like, how did this pass an ethics board? And then when I was reading about Alfred Kinsey, I don't know if anyone else who's watching has read about that man. And that's extremely traumatic to read. I'm not joking. Don't read that if you have a history of sexual abuse. It is horrific. He did terrible experiments on children that you would never get away with. I can't believe that place hasn't been burnt to the ground. The Kinsey Institute still stands, and they still have materials in there. Anyway, so I think that was a bit shocking to me. So that was my next article, and they had the Doctors in Schools program, where I thought, but adults aren't allowed to be in a room with children alone in a school for good reason. Why are we getting another adult who's allowed to touch them alone in a room with kids in school? What is going on? Where are all those safeguarding boundaries for kids?
Sorry, what are you saying there about people touching children in a room?
So there's a Doctors in Schools program.
Okay.
You know, they made this claim, oh, some parents don't have time to get their kids to the doctors. Right. And I just thought, never happened. What are you talking about? I've never seen that. I've never seen a family who couldn't get their kid to a doctor unless it's a literal, you know, abusive, neglectful situation, which would be for the DHS. Like, this is insane. And anyway, and you know, you can be, that was from age 12 that they could go to this doctor at school. The parents could sign a consent form. But I thought, you shouldn't be sending a child in alone to any room with any adult when they're 12. you just shouldn't be doing that. That's against all of our rules. How come that suddenly got thrown out of the window? And then I found out that they could be declared a mature minor after a couple of visits, and then they could do all kinds of things, get all kinds of treatments without parental consent, you know. And one of the things I had been upset about was that I was expected to lie to parents if the child had decided that they were now a different sex.
Right. So they could transition without parental
So consent? We were supposed – that's right. It's in the materials that if the child wants to socially transition at school, so live as the opposite sex, I'm not allowed to tell the parents if I don't think they'll be cooperative. And I just thought, I'm not going to lie to parents, and it should be against the law to lie to a parent about their own children.
Mm.
I mean, where did these ideas come from? You know, they just talked about how the child is the client. And I always thought, as a teacher, from my perspective, I used to say it to the kids, you know, I work for your parents. I'm legally your mum in here.
Yeah.
And so I need to care for you like you were my own children. I would say I've got my own child in school, and I hope that that teacher is, you know, looking after my child like I would look after her. But, you know, I wasn't against the parents. I wasn't trying to usurp the parents. And it just, it was all backwards. It was completely opposite to what I had wanted to go into teaching to do, which is to support children, support them to grow in partnership with the families. My favourite part of teaching, other than the actual teaching, was parent-teacher interviews where, you know, I could go on and on about how lovely their children were, because, you know, I've talked my husband's ear off at home and he's like, which kid is this again? What? You know. But they were interested, and I would notice all these funny little things about their kids that were just adorable, and, no one else would care except the parents, you know, and you could share that with them, and it was so nice. But it was just, it was all, teaching was turning into something different. It was turning into something secretive. It was turning into something very, it was about indoctrinating children into transgender ideology. You know, safe schools wasn't about anti-bullying, you know, when they described, you know, we've got to get rid of stereotypes. And I just thought, since when have we had stereotypes? We didn't even have stereotypes when I was in school. That's long gone. I mean, you're like 30 years too late, guys. Relax. It's okay. And, you know, and I was thinking, you know, bullying of gay kids, no one allows that to happen. Yes, it happens, but no one, show me a teacher that just says, yep, carry on. It doesn't happen. When bullying
the statistics about bullying, it's got more to do with like body image, intellectual ability, race, like cultural background. Sexuality seems to be very low down the list for bullying at school. Is that your experience?
And I've seen lots of research that shows it's attractiveness. So basically, if you are, if your peers perceive you to be unattractive and unintelligent and socially awkward, that's when they don't want to hang out with you. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're bullying you either. And I thought they were using the definition of bullying really loosely as well, because bullying is that sustained, targeted, relentless bullying. And I thought kids fight all the time. They're friends one day, they're not the next. I wouldn't have been labeling kids as bullies so quickly as the way that they were doing it, and they were describing it in the materials, you know. Yeah, there were lots of things that I didn't like about it. First was the professional boundaries issue. They were removing all those professional boundaries. I thought, why are you having erotic sex education? Why aren't you just keeping a bit basic and respecting the fact that they do not like to speak in great detail about these things in front of each other? I mean, the Safe Schools people, that Monash University, I've seen one of their own studies where you know, they asked kids, who do you want to teach you sex ed? They said their parent first, a same-sex, like auntie or some kind of adult friend next.
Yeah.
Like right down the bottom were teachers and in class. And I knew why, and it's because it's embarrassing in front of your peers. Yeah. They do want to know the information, but they don't want it to be talked about in great detail in front of their peers. That's embarrassing, especially when they've got both sexes in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, this is going to reduce the level of tolerance in schools. I remember reading, you know, a gender identity can change from hour to hour and day to day. And immediately I thought, well, no one's going to want to talk to that trans kid. They're going to be freaking out about upsetting that kid. They're going to have heart attacks. No one's going to go near that poor trans kid because they're going to be so stressed out about saying the wrong pronoun. I thought, no one's going to go near them.
Yeah.
You know, and
there'd be a lot of people this afternoon hearing you or watching this at whatever time of the day. Being really alarmed, thinking, oh, my goodness, if this is going on in the classroom, what should they do? What advice would you give to parents who have got children, particularly in the state education system, but not necessarily exclusively there? Any advice?
So the advice that I usually give parents is to ask the teachers very gentle questions and keep saying that you don't understand, because gender fluidity theory, this idea that you can change sex, that, you know, we have a sex and we have a personality. That's all we have. And what they've done is they've said sex is, you know, we can do something about sex. Your sex could be wrong.
Okay.
There's no scientific evidence for that. And also, we don't have personalities, we have gender identities. Yeah. And they use stereotypes to measure which gender identity you should have. And they have this spectrum. And I said, all you need to do is get them to ask questions, because there is no teacher on this planet that can explain this without making a fool of themselves.
Yeah.
No, you cannot, it cannot be done. It makes no sense. Yeah. And I said, you know, you don't want to be rude to the teacher. And if you just have to be really gentle and say, I'm so sorry, I just don't understand. Because if you're telling me that stereotypes are wrong, then why am I measuring my femaleness or maleness by these stereotypes here?
Yeah.
And what is sex? Is there any evidence? Is there a test to find out if I'm in the wrong body? Because I would hate to be in the wrong body. What if I'm in the wrong body? How do I know, miss? You know, and if they have an answer like, you'll just know, that's garbage. I mean, you know, changing, you know, those surgeries and those cross-sex hormones and those puberty blockers, they are a big deal. And it's not just, you know, putting on a different set of clothes or dyeing your hair. Yeah. So I encourage them, if they can't get their kids out of school or into a different school, or they think there's some kind of a zealot teacher there, because teachers can do whatever they want behind that closed door. I learned that. And I used to think that filming teachers was really wrong. Like, early on in my teaching career, a kid filmed a different teacher.
Okay.
And it got on the internet and it went on the news. This teacher was saying insane stuff. He sounded like a bit of a racist and a little bit Nazi. Like, he started talking in German. He was insane. And I just thought, oh, maybe kids should film these insane teachers. But I said to them after that, I said, look, can you not film me, please? Because he did it secretly, obviously. And I said, you've got 20 witnesses here. You shouldn't need to film me. If I do something wrong, there are 20 witnesses here. You know, you can tell on me and I'll have to apologize, and that's fine. But since all this safe school stuff has come out, I've actually seen a bit of footage where children have filmed the teachers, and it is so unacceptable that I've changed my mind. I don't think teachers, if that is the way they're going to behave, if they are going to be so hostile to parental rights, then they don't deserve the privacy.
Was there a moment or something that was said which particularly alarmed you?
So the footage that I saw, it was actually just footage of the ground. The girl was trying to get audio of a teacher describing how to masturbate, and she was saying this in a class with boys and girls. And she said, you know, I'm sorry to be graphic, but she was talking about how you should get into a bath and rub your breasts, get into some warm water. And I was like, what are you doing? That is so lascivious. That is so inappropriate. How can you be speaking like that in front of teenage boys? You have to be so careful the way you behave in front of teenage boys. They can take everything the wrong way. Imagine how awkward it would be if they got aroused. Imagine how awkward it would be for the girls to imagine that the boys were imagining them doing that. And I was like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I would be furious if that was my child in there. And I'm furious as a colleague that she did that. But that is not against the safe schools and comprehensive sexuality type education materials. That's exactly what they have.
Yeah.
And I just think, imagine a male teacher doing that. I could get away with saying anything then.
Yeah.
Like, full disclosure, when I was in high school, I was actually sexually harassed by a teacher. And I wasn't totally believed. I think now I know that they did believe me, because I found out years later that he had been complained about by four other girls before me. And I thought they didn't believe me, but they were terrified because I was complaint number four. But they just kept him there. And then a few years later, he did the same thing to another girl. But for me, though, he was trying to get me to go away to a caravan with him. He kept on trying to harass me. But my father was a teacher. And for all his flaws, I knew that my father would never put a hand on a kid and he would never hug a kid. And I had this breakdown, an absolute breakdown in year 12. I nearly failed, because I remember I didn't go to my locker because it was near his room. He was, like, following me around the school, trying to talk to me. He's like, oh, I think we need to talk about your problems. I'm fine. Anyway, my dad ended up finding me in the lounge room crying one morning, and I had been really hostile to my brother, and my father wouldn't let them touch me. I had stopped washing my hair, like all that classic stuff. I didn't know then that it was all this depressive behaviour. And he said, what's wrong, Moira? And I said, have you ever hugged a student? And he said, no, I would never do that. And then he just said, who hugged you? Like, he knew. And then I told him everything. And they rang up the principal and they're like, oh, you're just confused. Anyway, got out of that school. I think it was 6 or 7 years later in the newspaper. There he was, Herald Sun. He had actually had sex with a girl. And so in between the four girls that complained before me, there was me and then a few girls after me. Mm. And he'd actually ended up sleeping with some of them. So they never got rid of him.
And is the problem here, Moira, too, that the way grooming happens is it happens slowly, it happens with sexualized talk, and you're concerned that the Safe Schools program actually institutionalizes that sort of approach.
It gives them cover. So the things that teacher said to me that were inappropriate are the types of things that are in this, in these lessons. Like, he was asking me that stuff, what have I done? He would ask me that, and I would sort of just, you know, I don't know, I would walk off, I would just be embarrassed and walk away.
Yeah.
But I did complain about it and they still didn't believe me, but I would have had the right to say that that was sexual harassment. And now these kids are losing even more of their rights to say, look, you know, why are all these adults so interested in talking to kids about their sexual development, their erotic sexual development? It shouldn't be that detailed.
Yeah.
There's not enough boundaries there. And I think kids are less safe because of this. Let's not kid ourselves. These types of predators, they go where the victims are. They go where the prey are. They go where the kids are. That's where they go. It's not like they're not going to be in teaching.
Yeah, it really is where there's opportunity, isn't there?
Exactly. And they're going to love this. They would love this material. This will be their dream because they'll be able to get away with saying all kinds of things that other people, other teachers would be able to say, no, he stepped across a line. Whereas now, even teachers watching aren't going to be able to say, that guy stepped or that person stepped across a line. We need to watch that person, you know.
Yeah.
Everybody has lost their ability to protect children because of these materials.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems incredible, particularly in the light of the Royal Commission we've recently had into institutionalized child sexual abuse, that it really is, in a way, coming through the side door with what's happening through the Safe Schools program. If there are books or resources that people want to familiarise themselves with, what would you suggest that might help them to think through these issues?
On the transgender ideology in particular, there's a book called Transgender, One Shade of Grey, which is very good. Anything, you can read quadrant articles by Professor John Whitehall. There are pediatric endocrinologists all over the world coming out against even social transitioning. It's just the idea to implant the idea that you can change sex, that you could have been born in a wrong body, that is so untrue and abusive, and that shouldn't be allowed to be said to children, and that children don't even really understand. You know, there's research showing that they don't even understand, a lot of them, you know, that just putting on a dress doesn't turn you into a girl if you're a boy. You know, like, people say that they can decide their gender at 3 years old or something, and the research does not back that up. They are very, they have a very childlike understanding of the world right up until even seven. And as we know, you know, and I don't want to be part of that funneling process as a teacher, sending them off to the transgender clinics where then they get set on this railroad track to terrible puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones, surgeries, which, you know, are devastating and irreversible. It's it is absolutely horrific, and I don't want to be part of it, and I'm very disappointed that teachers would be part of it. I have numerous colleagues that are very upset about it, but, you know, some of my colleagues, disappointingly, have said to me, oh, I don't want to teach it. And I said, so what did you do? And they said, oh, I told them that I just didn't feel equipped to teach it. And I said, and then what happened? And what they did is they brought in an expert from La Trobe University to teach it instead. So, you know, I thought that was even worse. You should have said, oh, I'll teach it. I'll teach it. And then just, you know, teach it properly and teach it in a neutral way. This is one point of view. Yeah. That's the other thing about the curriculum. They don't say this is one point of view. You know, there's going to be less
new
tolerance.
Orthodoxy, is it? It's presented it really as the new is. Orthodoxy.
And so they have, it teaches a lot through role plays, and they have these imaginary stories, and always the people who disagree are non-allies. And what's a non-ally? They're enemies. You know, they leave that word out, but, you know, it hangs there between the lines.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's this big picture of a happy family of, you know, embracing inclusive people, and then these horrible, you know, old-fashioned, they always use old-fashioned, traditional, religious. They, you know, they have a token religious family that is accepting, but, you know, all the rest, they're enemies and they are bigots and, you know, they're painted as unscientific and backward, whereas there's no science for transgender ideology.
Yeah, well, I'd be thinking like every cell in our body either screams that we're male or female. And the irony is that people that hold to a gender binary worldview, where you're either male or female, are seen as backward and unscientific. It seems incredible.
Yeah, and I've had a few discussions with people who are transgender online. And, you know, so in terms of, because I have arced up about a few things, you know, like the changing of your birth certificate, you know, allowing men into women's spaces, males into females' toilets, change rooms, jails. Oh, there are terrible stories of what's happened. You know, a male rapist gets, you know, decides he's a woman, gets to go into a female jail and then continues to rape. It's just horrific. And, you know, I was thinking about my role as a teacher. You know, I have to be in the change rooms with the girls. And, like, I used to take a book with me and say, I'm here so that you don't bully each other and so that if you need help, I'll get you some help. Otherwise, I'm going to be reading my book. And I used to say that to them and then look down at my book to give them some privacy. They were already very, you know, careful and private anyway. But, you know, I was very aware that they were so vulnerable and, you know, I didn't want to upset them. And I thought, oh, that must be hard for them to have this strange adult in here. But then I just thought, wow, what if an adult male teacher decides he identifies as a woman and then gets put on shift in a swimming carnival or something? And I thought, no girl is going to want that person in that change room. And I wouldn't let them in. And I just realized, oh my goodness, I will lose my job. I'm going to lose my job. I can't be a teacher anymore. I am still a teacher doing emergency teaching and teaching, you know, and homeschooling and doing researching. So I'm doing all that. But I've still got my license to teach and I'm still invited to teach at schools, but, you know, not at a state school anymore. So much for that dream. But
I've got to ask you now, homeschooling, and I'm sure there'd be people out there that think, oh, from a pedagogical point of view, is there disadvantages or advantages in actually teaching your own children? Your thoughts?
So I think it can be done well and it can be done poorly.
Okay.
And like anything. But I think you would have to work very, very hard to do it worse than school. It would be very difficult to do a worse job than school.
Why is that? Because I'm sure there'd be a lot of people hearing you say that would immediately arc up and say, but there are many, many good teachers at state schools. I've had that experience myself. You know, why would you be so...
It's because the system is stacked against them. I used to get these kids in year 9, in year 10, and they didn't have a strong base of literacy. And I thought, why are you here? You need to stop what you're doing. How it was so humiliating for my students to get them to read out loud that I stopped doing it. I stopped asking my high school students to read out loud because at the end of the day, I had to get them ready to mark and to write an essay and then I would mark that. I was not there to teach them to read anymore. That teaching period had come and gone in primary school. And instead of being held back and actually taught those skills, they'd just been passed up over and over and over. And so then as a teacher, I don't actually have a choice. None of these teachers have a choice in what they teach. They have to teach to the curriculum. Yeah. And so I used to read out loud to them because then at least they wouldn't miss anything about the story. I would explain things, point out things they needed to pick up. This would be a good quote, wouldn't it? Do you think, what can we use from this page to prove whatever point, you know, you can just really explicitly teach them.
Yeah.
But I couldn't teach them how to read. That it was too late. That was very depressing. That was just shocking to me that they would go up and up and up. That was in expensive private schools too. But whereas at home, if you have a child who's slow in any area, you just slow down and you just make sure that they master those concepts. They're not going anywhere. They can't skip. They can't hide.
Yeah.
They have to master it or they just do it again and again until they get it. If you find that they're not getting it, then you think, well, I'm going to try something different. I'll try a different curriculum. Maybe I'll get a tutor. Maybe I'll call up a friend who's homeschooling. Maybe I'll look up online. There's huge homeschooling communities. It's very reactive to the child. It's really focused on the child and it's very effective. Like as a teacher, it is just so effective. It's just so effective. And I found it, you know, I know that I taught children things. I did some good things as a teacher, but in terms of effectiveness as a professional, it is extremely effective to work you know, with small groups of children and not letting them go on before they have mastered the technique. Whereas you can't do that, not in public or private schools. We just age them up. I've heard of a few schools that do a few different things. They have towers of learning. So you go to whatever maths level you're at, you go to whatever English level you're at. So they've had kids that whose second language is English, but they're excellent at maths and science. And so they have to go right down to the start in English, and they can excel and exceed and keep going in that other subject. Whereas if they're all in just one year level and clunking along, it's a bit ineffective.
How much do you think social media and the rise of technology is playing into the dumbing down of our education?
Oh, I think it's having a really big impact. And I think it's creating this, bringing home the stress of school. So there's no end to the social jungle now. There is no minute of the day, no space in your life where you're not connected to that horrific social jungle, which we know is vicious online. And I think it's very mentally unhealthy, and I think that affects their outcomes. I look at the stats every year for student anxiety, every year I check on that, and we're going up and up and up, and they feel distressed, they feel depressed. You know, it's hard to get motivated to get your grades right when you feel like your whole life is dependent on these, you know, social media. People can ruin you. You know, we know that you can become addicted to likes and things like that. And children are really, you know, you have to remember that their brains are such, you know, there's a lot of plasticity there. They're very vulnerable. And
so just on this regard, like, you know, President Trump was talking about, you know, banning TikTok or at least the ownership of it from China. And there's been numerous news articles in The Australian and other conservative outlets saying, actually, this might not be a bad thing. This could be a good thing. Whether it be, you know, other TikTok or other forms of social media. What's your thoughts there?
That's another benefit of homeschooling. My kids just don't have as much access to it at all. Mm-hmm. I do think that parents really need to do something about that. It's going to be very difficult. It is difficult. Your children whinge and whine. It's very easy to put your children in front of a screen. I think you just have to cop that difficulty for the sake of your kids, and you just have to take that hit. I don't know, you have to work it out in your own family, but I really do think that children need to learn about life, you know, away from the screens, that life exists, people exist, relationships exist, joy exists all by yourself in your bedroom with some toys or some pencil and paper and books. You don't actually need a single other human being. You can have some close friends. You don't need to have that many people in your life. You know, I used to work with some people who did disability, and they had this chart, and they would explain to the child with a disability, you have your inner circle, which is just a few people, then you have your outer circle, which is your friends, and it went out and out, and those people, you know, were less and less trustworthy and important in your life. So what they say doesn't matter, and you don't have to do it, and, you know, you judge it against what the people on the inner circle would say. And I feel like kids don't have a proper vision of who is important in their life and whose opinion to look at, to pay attention to. I feel that they're really drowning actually in social pressure as well. And then they just don't know how to have entertain themselves or be alone. They're consumers. They're not producers. You know, I said to my kids, we're going to take summer off this year, the 3 months, and they're just going to be doing science and reading. And then they have to be producers. I said, I won't give you jobs, but you have to be producing and, you know, entertaining yourselves, no screens. And they're excited about it. Wow. But that's because I've trained them. Yeah.
It's a big challenge being a parent today, and particularly with the rise of technology. Hey, everyone. Don't forget to tune in tomorrow night for the weekly wrap-up with Karina Ocotel. Some of the best stories of the week. It'll be unmissable viewing. A great recap of the week in case you've missed anything. That's tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. I'll see you then. Now, just one maybe final question. You're a researcher with the Church and Nation Committee of the Presbyterian Church of Australia. What are some of the issues that you are seeing for us as a culture that is coming over the hill that people should be aware of and that are of particular concern to you?
Without a doubt, it is this lack of freedom, this encroaching legal regime where we're losing freedom of speech. What they, especially in Victoria, they're looking to lower the threshold for hate speech, you know. So now, instead of having intended to cause offence or humiliate, you don't need to have intended to do it. This law hasn't gone through yet, but it's written. It's there. They're waiting. And you just see this push towards, and, you know, there's a whole LGBTQI strategy being pushed through at the moment. We just did a submission for that. And they want to get rid of every single exception to the Sex Discrimination Act, that, you know, all the religious exemptions that we had for hiring, you know, Christians in a Christian school, Muslims in a Muslim school. Of course, they keep it for themselves. Labor Party are able to hire only Labor voting people for their organization.
Funny how that works out.
That's right. But everybody else, you have to take in people who are going to actively work against your ethics. Yeah. And so they're really trying to get rid of that. And I just feel that we're heading towards quite a hostile and divided culture if this keeps going. And Victoria is clearly the trailblazer.
What would you, when you, I mean, I think a lot of people would be aware of those sort of things, maybe to differing degrees of concern, but what would be your encouragement to people? How should they respond?
Well, in democracy, it's a numbers game, and it's really important that if you want your particular political party to listen to you, they're actually more likely to listen to you if you join them, if you're a paid-up member. So I know that's not popular to get all political, but, you know, where do these cultural changes happen? They happen through lawmaking. It happens through politics. And, you know, if you want to choose who a political party puts up for a spot, who chooses to be on that public voting ticket, then you need to get in there and help choose that person. Not all political parties will actually let you do that. You have to research that. Support particular politicians, like Mark Latham's latest bill. I think it's fantastic, the one that re-enshrines parental rights. I love that law. I really wish it had been the Liberal Party that brought it out. It wasn't.
Yeah.
But I hope we support him in that, because, you know, that's fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, really, you know, it's the people who make the laws are the ones we need to influence. So you can sign a petition, and that's good. But they're more afraid of the people inside their parties than outside their parties, I think, because, you know, people just vote with who they're voting for. That, you know, you've got your dead red seats, your blue ribbon seats, and that doesn't necessarily change that often.
Yeah.
But you can change who they put up in those seats.
Yeah, I've heard it said, like, in Sydney or in New South Wales, for instance, where I am, there's something like only 33,000 people are formally associated with a particular political party. But how many millions of people live in New South Wales? So it really is a classic case of the tail wagging the dog, isn't it? And absolutely. I would think that it's a similar sort of situation in Victoria. So in a democracy, it's every citizen's right, isn't it? Or actually responsibility to be involved.
I think it's a responsibility. I look at it as that, because at the moment I think that political parties are just swamped with people who are political tragics, who don't have real lives, no offence. People will think I'm one of those now, but you know, really, they're careerists, or they just want to hang around power. I don't know. It's a very weird world now that I'm in it. It's so strange. Yeah. And I think they need real ordinary people who don't want to be a politician, but they're not going to support someone who supports that garbage, you know. And so then, but they've got that internal vote. They can do something about it, which, you know, because inside a party, your vote is, you know, one out of, I don't know, maybe 200, maybe, you know, maybe 1,000, whereas outside it's one out of 40,000. Yeah. You know, it's just a numbers game. We've got to get really smart about this. And I love The Good Source. That's fantastic that we've got our, you know, a platform for these types of views. That's one thing as well. We need to coordinate with each other. And that's how you do it. You raise the publicity, you raise the awareness, and, you know, you get your number, you get your ticket, you get your vote.
Yeah, great. Well, look, Moira, it's been fantastic having you on this afternoon, and I'm sure we're going to have you back on again. In fact, you could probably even have your own segment, I'm sure.
Oh, no, I'm too busy.
Oh, you say that now. But it's been great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us. If people want to check out more of what Moira has written, you can go to thegoodsource.com, or you can go to The Spectator, where she has a number of articles there already. Just Google Moira Deeming at thespectator.com.australia. It's been great to have you once again with us on The Good Source. I'm Mark Powell. This has been Cultural Markisms, and I look forward to having you, or seeing you, next time on the show. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Cultural Markisms is a production of The Good Source, hosted by Mark Powell. To watch, listen to, or read more content without the SJW PC fact filter, visit goodsource.news. That's good, S-A-U-C-E, .news. Become a Good Source supporter for exclusive access to live and unedited interview recordings, including the conversations before and after the show.